This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 2nd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 420. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, the stakes are high in a world holding its breath for each move by Trump, Putin, and Xi. To talk about the latest geopolitical trends, I welcome back Christian Luprecht, a political science professor from the Royal Military College of Canada. Christian Luprecht was in Vancouver to be a keynote speaker at the Vancouver International Security Summit in October.
This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast.
At the 2025 Vancouver International Security Summit in October, drones and artificial intelligence were constant themes. Will they make the world safer? Or will they make the world more dangerous? One of the keynote speakers at the summit was Christian Luprecht, a political science professor from the Royal Military College of Canada. Professor Luprecht joined me for a wide-ranging interview about military technology, security for FIFA World Cup 26, Mark Carney's first 6 months as Prime Minister, and Canada's relationship with China. Weapons that are being deployed on a daily basis in Ukraine especially, there are concerns about drones being deployed at the FIFA World Cup 26 here in Vancouver and Toronto and the other host cities in the United States and Mexico. Where is this technology going, and are our governments going to be able to protect us from it?
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly dual-use technology, not just in terms of a technology of warfare, but a technology of disruption, right? If you look at the recent civilian drone flights, for instance, over the Copenhagen airport that closed the airport, those drones likely came off the Russian shadow fleet, over Oslo and over the Munich airports, and the disruptive effects that that those have had. And of course, we're all familiar with the drone incursions into Poland, into Romania. We've had significant drone sightings over military installations in Europe, both for intelligence gathering purposes and disruptive purposes. But what's really one of the interesting elements that emerged in Romania is that, for instance, Romania did not have the legislative framework without declaring an act of war to shoot down those drones. And so one of the interesting questions is, how do we posture ourselves in a resilient fashion, right? Ukraine demonstrated that in an act of asymmetric warfare, it took out 20% of Russia's strategic nuclear fleet with a few drones that they smuggled into Russia. You know, so Russia lost more assets of their nuclear fleet in a couple hours than they had lost during their entire Cold War to accidents and anything else. So it was quite astounding the impact that you can have. And so certainly it's it has been a considerable concern, but it is now a growing concern. Not even in the event of like an attack, but to the extent to which adversaries can use this to, you know, if you're an adversary and you know we use these gray zone tactics, you would simply, for instance, want to undermine the legitimacy of the government of Canada to provide public safety. So simply being able to run an illicit drone over Vancouver Airport or over one of the FIFA installations or so, and as a result, authorities having to take all sorts of precautionary measures, would have significant disruptive events, and the adversary would likely exploit that also in the information domain to kind of show that, look, countries can provide for their security and so forth. So it's definitely something that authorities are wrestling with, in addition to all the other security challenges that we already have. You know, if you think about terrorist challenges, you think about people with mental health challenges and the like. You think about, for instance, the movement of people between Canada and the United States during the FIFA World Cup under the current conditions of the challenges that we have around the border. And movement around the border, and how do we issue people visas both for Canada and the United States in a way that's actually cohesive. So this certainly adds yet one more dimension. And the challenge here is that these things always work, if you have lots of room to plan. But the challenge here is, not only is the runway relatively short, this technology is evolving very quickly in terms of what you can do with those drones and the disruptive effects that you can have in terms of disrupting communications, for instance, for people's mobile phones and the like. So so you can bet that in terms of security preparations, people have been watching what's happening in Europe and going, we'll need to step up. But if you're planning this, there's only so much in your hands locally and even provincially, because, for instance, if we don't have robust legislative frameworks that would allow law enforcement or defense mechanisms to intervene, for instance, with electronic warfare to disable a drone like that, that might be over a critical infrastructure installation. So there's also a lot of heavy lifting that needs to be done by Ottawa. And my worry would be is Ottawa actually paying enough attention to make sure that we're not just technically up to speed, but we have our legislative frameworks and our interagency frameworks up to speed, because the feds are doing a better job at working amongst themselves, but there's still a lot of work to do in this country in terms of the feds working with provinces and local authorities to make sure that we're world class, as is required for an event like FIFA. Of course, NORA at the North American Aerospace Defense Command, that sort of is in charge of protecting our airspace, has very effective detection and response protocols. The airspace that's the best protected in North America is that over Washington, D.C., which won't come as a surprise to anybody. But the Americans have taken some exceptional measures over D.C., both in terms of the ability to intercept drones and other aerial systems, and in terms of the response time. And the response time here is critical because, of course, Canadian politicians will need to decide how much responsibility do I delegate to the local authorities? Because once the drone is flying, you don't have 10 minutes to call folks in Ottawa, what are we gonna do, and so forth. You need to act, and you need to act now. And some of those actions, the Americans have decided that they have given fairly broad authorities to protect the airspace, in particular over DC. The Americans are very well rehearsed at this, for instance, over things like the Super Bowl, that is very well protected in terms of drones. Are we in Canada prepared to delegate to our own authorities those same capabilities? And some rather interesting measures that, you know, we might not all disclose that authorities can take, so how much, how we delegate is interesting. Look, in terms of China, look, we run this huge port in Vancouver. You'll be familiar with the report that Delta has commissioned about criminal activity coming out of the port. We don't have a federal port police anymore, so there's a lot of debate about how do we secure the port. And the same way that the Russians flew drones off their shadow fleet just off the sea on Copenhagen, the Chinese or others could be flying drones off vessels right here in the port of Vancouver or out in the bay, sort of as you're pulling in. And so have we thought about, for instance, how are we gonna make sure that the ships that we're admitting into our waters are ships that aren't gonna be used for disruptive or hybrid purposes? Those ships can be stacked with communications equipment that can have serious disruptive effects. GPS jamming, which is the flavor of the day in the Baltic states, for instance, for civilian aircraft. Are we preparing the Vancouver airport for possible jamming activities of Chinese vessels off our shores here? There's a lot of scenarios that, and I could probably come up with a dozen other sort of scenarios if I was an adversary and I was determined to be disruptive. And, it's a new world, and part of it is a question also to what extent are Canadians behind the requirements to posture ourselves more robustly? Are we prepared to actually understand that this country, we're no longer living in a period of peace, we're not living in a period of war, we're living in a period of constant conflict where our adversaries are constantly pushing our boundaries, and where the best way to make sure that we show that we will not, we will defend our way of life, is to be able to detect these disruptions, to be able to disable, to disrupt these attempts to disrupt our society. Are Canadians prepared to take the measures that are required to make sure that the major world event that we're going to stage here is not going to be disrupted by nefarious actors?
And this is also happening at a time when Canadians, not only is there the BC Ferries deal to build four ships at a Chinese state-owned shipyard, but heavy lobbying going on in Ottawa to end the tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles and allow the Chinese electric vehicle industry into Canada at a time when Donald Trump wants to attract or repatriate various American-owned auto companies back into the U.S., leaving a potential vacuum here. We're hearing from Prime Minister Mark Carney that he's getting closer to a meeting with Xi Jinping. Anita Anand has been to Beijing to talk to officials there. At the same time as China is stepping up its efforts on its efforts to destabilize the West, we're wanting to get closer to China economically at the highest levels. How do you resolve that?
So there's a political strategy as a middle power where you never want to get caught in the spats between superpowers. And so Canada's finding itself in a really hard place where it's now being, it's obviously now under some sense of duress by both the United States and China. Look, when we need to trade those off, we always got to put our money on the United States if we're going to have to make a choice here, and we can only hope that the government will act in the best interests, in the best national interest, in the best interest of all Canadians, rather than in the interests of people who might be close to the governing party or who might be have particular financial interests in China. I've also always been puzzled about why we make China such a big priority. China is 4% of our exports, and those exports are largely agricultural products. The government can backstop economic duress by China. I'm not sure why we're letting this country exert this much influence over us. I think at the same time, look, China is not going away as a challenge, but it's also not going away as a partner. So we're going to need to learn to live with China, and just like, increasingly our interests do not align neatly with those of the United States. And so there's an element of statecraft and diplomacy where we need to craft our separate path. The problem is we have for decades not invested in the instruments of statecraft that would allow us to use diplomacy, soft power and hard power, and a creative combination of cooperation with allies and partners to have both a carrot and a stick approach with China. If Canada was a real partner to Europe and had the European Union on side, we would obviously have much more leverage with China than we do on our own. Given how much agricultural products China procures from Canada, the United States, and Australia, right there's significant leverage that we have over China. Look, I mean, if Canada, Australia, and the U.S. stop agricultural products to China today, people would go hungry in China within days. If China wants to play hardball with us, I'm not saying that we should play hardball, but if we had an effective both sovereignty strategy and alliance and allied and partner country strategy, this country would be could be in a fairly strong position in the way it negotiates, but that requires us to perhaps sideline some Canadian investments that might be put at risk. And so it'll be interesting to see what path the government chooses in order to best assert our interests. But clearly, I think we have learned that China can never be counted on as a trusted partner, and so that we will always need to hedge on that relationship. And we know that we simply can no longer draft behind the United States, as we've done so conveniently for 75 years. I think Canadians now, there's a broad consensus that we need to be more robust in our security posture, we both of those countries. I'm not sure that Canadians have understood that we live in this area of persistent conflict, and that will require significant investments in our instruments of statecraft, and that those investments will ultimately come at some trade-off to the quality of the way of life that we live, because there's only so much money to go around, and so it'll require governments to make hard decisions, and I'm not sure our Canadian politicians will be prepared to make the sort of decisions that would be in the long-term interests of Canadians and of Canada as a country, but that would impose some short-term, I don't want to say pain, but some short-term trade-offs on the Canadian population, and are prepared to actually explain that to Canadians.
And during the symposium, you were on a panel about Canada and the European Union, and how Canada and the European Union can draw closer together through transatlantic ties, transatlantic trade. And you mentioned history from way back in the early 1970s. That seems really close to today, when Richard Nixon was flexing his muscles, tariffing various allies, including Canada, in order to bolster his power and his economic power in the United States, and how Canada at the time turned to Europe. And we're seeing some of the same things happen now, of Canada turning towards Europe because of Trump and the tariffs that are affecting Canada. But there was unfinished business that you mentioned, that Canada could have still signed other deals with Europe back then that could have put Canada in a stronger position today.
Yeah, we talked about the third option back then, under Pierre Elliott Trudeau. But we never really followed through in making this a very robust effort to find a greater balance, in part because it's so convenient. When you're next door to the largest economy of the world, it's relatively easy and cheap to sell all of your stuff to the US. And of course, with the free trade agreement with the United States, the FTA 1988, and then subsequently the North American Free Trade Agreement, our dependency, more by consequence than by design, on the United States, that heightened it even further, where back then it was 3/4 of our exports that went to the US. Now I think it's about 84 or something like that percent. Don't quote me exactly sort of on the numbers here. But so one of the challenges, how do we get away from that north-south integration, both regional as well as national? Because this would require us to have a more east-west type integration, both across the countries and, of course, the Indo-Pacific and the transatlantic. And we know that after 150 years, we're still trying to figure out how we can actually trade across provinces in this country, east-west. So now we're trying to figure out how we're going to pivot to Europe or to the Indo-Pacific. But look, there's other countries that don't have our blessings, right? Look at a country like Korea that doesn't have the resources that we have, that has become a global powerhouse by diversifying, by investing heavily in high technology. You know, there's similar countries within the European Union, you know, to us, in terms of, think of Spain, think of the Netherlands, for instance, in terms of sort of their middle power status. So there's certainly other examples of how you assert yourself in a globalized world with the interests that you have, and defend the principles and values and the world that you ultimately believe in. The challenge is that requires the political will and a public understanding of the decisions that are required, rather than always taking, you know, what's the path of least resistance. Working with the United States is always going to be the path of least resistance, but working with the United States is always going to bear risks. I mean, it's 250 years, 1775, George Washington marched on Quebec City and tried to take Quebec City. This is not new. the Americans sort of causing some challenges for our sovereignty is not new. What, of course, we did forget for the first time in 100 years, it seems over the last at least 10 years or so, is that we need to hedge against that eventuality, that we always need to hedge against the vagaries of U.S. unilateralism. So the wake-up call here is, okay, so if we're going to have this close relationship with the United States, we need to have allies and partners who are going to stand up for us. And what's puzzling to me, well, it's not puzzling, is look at the silence around the world, especially among our closest partners in Europe, when our economic and political sovereignty is threatened. And that's because we haven't been good allies to our partners in Europe. So here's the opportunity for us to rethink, how do we make sure we actually have those friends in times of need that are not the Americans and that will stand up for our sovereignty and for our interests with us when that day comes, whether it's the United States, whether it's China, or whether it's what other challenge we're going to face in this increasingly volatile global world.
I want to end by tying back to your first appearance on the Breaker.News podcast, where you talked about Mark Carney, and you called him a techno-populist, the first techno-populist, a technocrat with populist leanings. And here we are in the fall of 2025. He emerged as the Liberal Party leader in the winter and won the spring election. What is your report card on Mark Carney's performance domestically and on the world stage?
Well, as you know, when Chairman Mao was famously asked about the implications of the French Revolution, he said it is too early to tell. It'll be interesting to see whether I think Prime Minister Carney has big plans for this country. We will have to see whether his personal style of governing can translate those plans into real action. And by that, I mean that he's not an Ottawa insider. He doesn't have a lot of experience in politics per se. And he came up in an era in the 1980s, 1990s where you did even corporate governance very differently, much more hierarchically, much more directed than is the style today. So will he be able to bring together the civil servants around Ottawa, the members of his own party and of the opposition, Canadian provinces and Canadians, to give him the license that is necessary for the major changes that I think he has in mind? Will he have the patience to explain to Canadians what he's doing, why he's doing this, and why this is good for the country? And look, we've had leaders who had very short stints as prime minister, but ultimately had a monumental impact on this country. I think of Mike Pearson, for instance, Lester B. Pearson. And we've had liberal leaders who had very short stints and it didn't end well, and we might think of more recently Paul Martin. So I think, if nothing else, Mark Carney is somebody who's highly ambitious. He's clearly somebody who's very smart. He surrounded himself with people who are very capable in his inner entourage. But whether that translates into governance that it can achieve the effects that he is hoping and looking for, and do that in a sustainable fashion rather than just thinking ahead to the next election, that is a tall order. And I would say the jury is out of how he's going to go down in Canadian political history.
That was Professor Christian Luprecht from the Royal Canadian Military College after the 2025 Vancouver International Security Summit on October 16th and 17th.
Look, it's a real pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In Focus Taiwan.tw, Taiwan slams China for designating October 25th as Taiwan Restoration Day. The decision by the Chinese authorities to establish a so-called commemoration day of Taiwan's restoration is an attempt to belittle our country and fabricate the claim that Taiwan belongs to the PRC, said the Mainland Affairs Council. Taiwan Retrocession Day commemorates October 25, 1945, when representatives of the Republic of China, on behalf of the Allied powers, accepted the surrender of Japanese forces in Taiwan. The council also noted that the Chinese Communist Party had not yet established the PRC in 1945. In Kyoto news, China, Japan top diplomats seek mutually beneficial ties in phone talks. China's top diplomat, Wang Yi, and his Japanese counterpart, Toshimitsu Motegi, agreed during phone talks Tuesday to promote their country's strategic and mutually beneficial relationship and build constructive and stable ties, the Japanese foreign minister said. In ABC News Australia, Bureau of Meteorology ordered to fix new website after torrent of complaints. The Bureau described the changes as modern and sleek, but the federal government has told the Bureau to fix the new $4.1 million website after complaints by Australians, including farmers who are finding it difficult to use. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, the Buffalo Pothole Bandit hits Portland with street art. The bandit filled 30 potholes with mosaics in an effort to share art and boost morale, including an airport carpet-themed design, tiny milk and cookies, and a ladybug wearing a crown, even a Buffalo Bills logo near Tinker Tavern, a Bills bar. The Portland Bureau of Transportation would not comment on the guerrilla art pothole movement because sidewalk maintenance is the responsibility of adjacent property owners, not the city. In Cascadia Daily News, waterfront's future is a balance of economic opportunity and public value. Port Commission candidates say waterfront development must be uniquely Bellingham. The future of the waterfront is a driving factor in the Port of Bellingham Board of Commissioners race. Candidates have to balance a series of competing interests, providing high-wage jobs and economic development, ecological conservation, and public access to the waterfront. General Election Day in Whatcom County is November 4th. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. MLA asks, why does EB dump on Trump but let Xi go free? And Vancouver mayoral contestant Alam wants to annex the university endowment lands. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, because love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone. You won't stand alone.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the folks behind Movember Canada and those who grow a mo to help a bro. It is Movember again for the 22nd year. It is time to raise money for mental health, suicide prevention, prostate and testicular cancer programs. I'm pitching in again. Will you join me? Go to ca.movember.com. That's Movember with an M. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 2nd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 2nd of November in 1951, in the Korean War, 29 members of the Royal Canadian Regiment battled Chinese troops at Songgok Spur? One of them, 21-year-old Private Joseph Campo, died in the battle. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.